Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahulastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, welcome to another Rahulastapa Book Club. I'm very excited to say we have Brenna Hassett here, who's written a fantastic book called Growing Up Human, The Evolution of Childhood. Hello, Brenna.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Now, you were pregnant when you wrote this book and you're pregnant now. And it was in lockdown when you wrote the book, so I'm presuming it's not the same pregnancy.
It is, in fact, a different baby. So given what I've written, you'd think I'd know better.
That's true. Well, hopefully we're quite close to the due date, but not. It's a week or so away, so hopefully we won't be giving birth. But we will carry on. If that goes, that we have to catch, the show must go on. Brenna, tell us a little bit about, first of all, before we get onto the book, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
So I have a particularly odd job. I am essentially a digger up of dead people's teeth. That right. would be the absolute description of what I actually do. But if you want to get a job, what you do is you get a PhD and you call yourself a biological anthropologist. So I look at the history of health and particularly of death through skeletons and through the human past and try and figure out what exactly we've been up to. I'm at UCL right now and I'm a scientific associate at the Natural History Museum. So at least someone believes that that's a reasonable thing to do.
So you're sort of time traveling retrospective tooth fairy is the you don't pay for the teeth.
If Tooth Fairy had like a CSI spin-off, that would be me.
I think we'll work on that together. That sounds like a good idea. You've written one other book before, is that right? Called Built on Bones.
Yeah. So that one's much more, many more dead people in that one, if people are more focused on the dead people aspect.
Okay. And this one is, well, tell us, it's a very, I mean, there's so many talking points in this book. I don't think we'll get through everything I want to talk to you about. Could you tell us what you consider the book to be and why you wanted to write this particular book?
Well, I mean, one thing was, of course, there was a pandemic and I was very pregnant, and I was suddenly quite interested in the science of being pregnant. And it occurred to me that pregnancy was unreasonable, childbirth was unreasonable, children in general were unreasonable. But, you know, reproduction is a really important part of a species sort of deal. Like, if you don't reproduce, you're not a species. So, you know, there's science behind this, and I decided that I would have a closer look. I'm not sure I liked what I found, but it was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, well, it is when you look at it, it's not something I'd thought about at all before. And this book covers a lot of subjects that I'm interested in. Again, genitalia, childish, Pompeii comes into it as well. It's almost like it's written for me, but I hadn't really considered the fact that human beings have this extraordinary long sort of prolonged childhood, which is that unique in the animal kingdom?
Yeah, I think it's something that a lot of people don't appreciate. We sort of know, oh, evolution, isn't it weird? We walk upright, we have fire, we have podcasts, you know. But the thing is that we are children forever. Some of us longer than others.
Yeah,
I may have gotten in some slight trouble suggesting that the age was about 40, but that was very critical to a plea made to my parents around the same age. But it's amazing. I mean, a bowhead whale lives, a couple hundred years? They have the same length of childhood we do, sort of right. 25 years, let's say, just for the physical growing bit. The emotional bit's on you. But, you know, the physical growing bit, we have the same childhood as you know, a whale that's going to outlive us by centuries. That's not normal. That's extraordinary. That's something that we've obviously chosen to do evolutionary-wise. And, you know, you've got to take a look at the pieces to put that together to see exactly how we made this really incredible evolutionary leap.
And it, you know, it's the book's quite the science is quite mathematical, as it would be, because it's all about, you know, trading off one thing against another for the best chance of survival. So many animals, I mean, you talk very early on and throughout the book about the pizza rat, which is a rat that's been videoed taking a big piece of, is it a whole pizza or a big piece of pizza down into
a
Subway?
It's a New York slice. So you got to understand, right. A New York slice is immense. You know, they're right. Just huge. So for a UK audience, it might be a whole pizza.
Okay. So you know, a rat has lots of babies all at once, and their childhood is short compared to other mammals. But for humans, we tend to have one or two at a time, and this extended. And it's all about, you know, it's sort of about how much resources you're prepared to put into your child versus how likely the child is to survive in a sort of mathematical sense, right?
Yeah, and I mean, so we're trying in biology very hard to move away from some of these hard and fast rules, but you know, one of the things is like this sort of R versus K mortality versus fertility. What's driving your species? And you know, the cold hard cash of it is sort of, if you've got babies that are not necessarily all going to make it, you're really not going to put the effort into each and every one. So something like a rat that's hauling off massive slices of pizza down some Subway steps to feed billions of babies, not billions, like 12, but still, it's a lot of rats. You don't want to have 12 babies at once. You know, it's got a different strategy from something like a human that is going to have this extended pregnancy and put just an insane amount of resources into each and every single baby. And we do that, it's kind of nice, because we really think those babies are going to live. You know, we put our effort in because we think it's going to be worth it.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting when it comes down to it, because in a way it sort of takes out emotion and love and things, though those things are obviously important in terms of creating the bonds. And I mean, you sort of discuss in the book at one point whether it makes more sense in reproductive terms. And obviously this all works because, you know, if you're reproductively successful and you have your way of living is successful, then your species will survive. So it's sort of not a choice. But you talk about the difference between having a male and a female child in terms of whether that will lead to reproductive success for the next generation.
Yeah, so that's a really sort of interesting, I don't know where the actual proof is going to fall on this, because sometimes these studies, you look at them and say, someone has gotten money to see if billionaires have more sons than daughters. Why can't I get that kind of money? And I'm really not sure about this research design. But, you know, these are things that have been put forward. So one of the hypotheses is that daughters are a sure thing, that most females will reproduce. And most females, and we apply this to primates as well. So it's not just, it's the rest of the monkeys and the apes, not just us. But because, you know, women reproduce at a steady rate, they're a sure bet. You know, they're a pretty solid bet. But if you have males, some of them are not going to reproduce at all. And some of them are going to go full Genghis Khan, Brendan O'Bain, whatever, and they're going to dominate the gene pool. So you can have really successful sons or you can have really non-successful sons. When times are tough, you might opt for the sure option, the steady bet. But, the idea was that if you've got billionaires, they might actually go for more sons. It's kind of hard to tell how this mechanism would actually work, especially given that, that's not how choosing the sex of the baby sort of, I mean, it's a problem that's been plaguing us since Henry VIII. It's not something that's easily done.
No. Well, like I say, there's so much to talk about in this book. And I will just, it's absolutely fascinating and makes you think about all sorts of things. I'm going to just concentrate for a moment on a few of the things that I picked up and that cross over with some of my own work. I've written a book I've written two books, one about the penises and now I've just written a book about testicles, and I was glad to see that both of those parts as well as female parts feature in this book, though you're quite disparaging about the human penis. You call it the most basic primate penis available, which I was quite affronted by. But there's interesting stuff about male genitalia being indicative of whether a species is monogamous or less monogamous, right?
Yes. So to really understand this kind of anthropology, you have to put yourself into the mindset of a male researcher in the 1960s or something like that, and just really understand the only interesting question about evolution is how we got to the penis size that we currently have. So it turns out there's been a lot of research on relative primate penis shape, size. And so what we know is that primates come with a whole host of options for genitals that you may not expect. The phrase penis spikes is just not something that you really want to sort of think about in our species, but it is something, flanges and spikes, the os baculum, so an actual bone that sort of supports the penis. These are all kind of embellishments that can add a competitive edge to a male mating strategy. And so what we're really talking about when we're talking about genital design is mating strategy, is how do you and your genetic material become the most successful genetic material? A lot of this actually does come down to research done on testes size, particularly like relative testes size. So if you were a mouse lemur and you were to perhaps have access to scales and some, issues personally, you would be able to measure yourself and find out that each individual testicle is about, relative to your body, the size of a grapefruit for a human. The mouse lemurs, champions of the primate testicle size range. And it turns out that that testes size versus the body size is something that relates to kind of how competitive your mating is. So if you need to make sure that your genetic material is getting out on top, you need to make a lot of genetic material and you need to deliver that genetic material. So that's where things like length, girth, the aforementioned penis spikes, which I really should stop talking about, those are all aspects of competitive mating. And you know who doesn't have competitive mating? Us!
Right.
And kind of marmosets, though marmosets do some other stuff, like the females sort of suppress ovulation through terror and glandular secretions. So the reason that we find this whole sort of super unimpressive genital package interesting, because it actually tells us that we have this sort of non-competitive mating regime. We're not doing what's called scramble mating, which is exactly what you expect it would be. We are pretty much a pair bonded species, which is the most boring you could get. And it's also super, super weird because like less than 5% of the animal kingdom does it.
Yeah, that's all very interesting. Now, there's a bit in my book about testicles, which I was just interested to see what you think about this, that some people have argued, I think not particularly successfully, that human testicles are as vulnerable and weird as they are, as because they're sort of like a peacock's feather in terms of if your mate sees how brave you are and having your testicles dangling around and they're so vulnerable, that will make you sexually attractive. I have to say, I don't think my testicles have ever attracted a sexual mate. Well, how do you feel? How do you feel about that?
That is, you know what, that is actually a completely new theory on me. I'm interested, but I'm not sure about it. I mean, we say the same thing about concealed ovulation. So, you know, why, if you're an olive baboon and it's time to mate and you're a girl, stuff swells up, it goes bright red. All the olive baboons in the neighborhood know what's up. Humans, we hide that. Because we use sex for social reasons, it doesn't need to be tied to reproduction for us. So we have all sorts of theories about why we're hairless, one of which is, you know, to make our bottoms look like we're constantly ready for sex. We have just some very odd ideas. And I think perhaps like the, shall we say, decorative testicle theory, you know, some of these might reveal slightly more about the researchers involved.
Well, the book is very funny. There's a lot of, you know, it's a great read. There's a lot of very funny footnotes particularly, but it motors along and is amusing as well as being full of a lot of science and a lot of facts. You know, I think you're very strong on the fact that historically the people, as we have already touched upon in this, historically the people investigating all of these areas are men, and that the science is very male driven. You're very Plutarch comes in for quite a kicking in this book. I hope you're
such a miserablest, though. I mean, God, he complains about everything. I mean, how could you not come across Plutarch? I mean,
But it's interesting because, again, I think this is a thing that's coming through now as we're getting a little more equality in research and in sciences and hopefully everywhere, that, you know, a male perspective has skewed a lot of these subjects. Just the other day I read that, you know, science has only just discovered there are more nerve endings in the clitoris than were previously thought. And, you know, as you say, if that was a penis, we'd have found that out 200 years ago, but no one's been looking at the clitoris for some reason.
It is exactly that. Yeah.
So it's very interesting to get this book and to realize how much of the prejudice about ideas of evolution come from the people writing about evolution. Even Charles Darwin, you're slightly cheeky about.
Well, he was less than polite about the capacities of women. So
yes,
I feel like it's fair, but it is true, and it's that, you know, the whole subject of kids, babies, how we raise them. I mean, it's obviously how we get to be who we are as a species, but it's like, shouldn't we care about that? It's like, no, it's chick stuff. It's like, oh,
yes. Yeah. Well, it's not to think. I mean, I know, like, historically, again, science, maybe in the ancient times, people thought, oh, women produce babies and weren't aware that men were involved. Then when they realized men were getting involved, everything became a bit more kind of fair. But then sort of religion started believing it was only men. I mean, that one of my research things from Talking Cock was, my book Talking Cock, was that for a long time, you know, it was believed that the sperm was basically a homunculus that was planted in the soil of the woman whose only job was to grow the child and didn't do anything else. And so that sort of pervasive idea of a patriarchal society obviously leaks into science as well as everywhere else.
Yeah, and it still leaks is probably an interesting word to use, but the sort of, you know, it still does get in there. You know, we have anthropologists going, oh, well, you know, these guys over in the Trobriand Islands or these guys in Papua New Guinea, they don't really understand paternity because they're not viciously killing each other whenever their women have, you know, babies with other people. It's like, maybe they just don't do that. You know, maybe you have some hang-ups yourself, Mr. 19th century anthropologist, that you should perhaps investigate before accusing the rest of humanity.
Yeah, well, it's very good for that. And yeah, absolutely, you know, the need, given, you know, the importance of mothers in this particular subject and the importance of females, you know, the needs of women and the opinions of women seem to be quite important, at least.
Yeah. And I think it also, I mean, the disservice goes both ways. I mean, one of the sort of obsessions with our kind of genitals and monogamy, you know, one of the conclusions it actually leads us to, but people don't talk about as much, is how important it is to have dads that do a lot of caring.
Yeah.
You know, we've got, you know, we always talk about moms and the evolution of childhood, but we should point out that, you know, those marmosets, the ones with the glandular secretions and the rule by terror, you know, they're monogamous. And the reason they have to be monogamous is because they need a marmoset dad, because they have exactly one more baby than they can carry.
Right.
You need a marmoset dad.
Yeah.
This is, you know, and that's actually, you know, these sort of caring responsibilities, getting other people to care for our stupidly expensive, useless babies, turns out to be a major evolutionary thing. So just kind of discounting them because you've got 19th century ideas doesn't really work.
Yeah, and you know, and I think people, I think you touch on this as well, that it's sort of, there was an idea that, I mean, because of huge infant mortality, I think people assumed that people in the past couldn't have loved their babies as much as we love our babies and didn't like children, which seems like against all logic, because why would we suddenly, if it wasn't there in the past, we wouldn't suddenly evolve this, you know, that paternal and maternal love must be in us. But that's a sort of
weird possible
idea.
Exception of Plutarch, right? He's the one who sort of tells us that you know, Romans didn't care for their babies and they wouldn't have funerals. And of course, I mean, as an archaeologist, is the sort of sad and depressing part of my job, but of course we do find grave inscriptions for much loved children, and there's no reason to think that people didn't love their children just as much as we did in the past. They just, you know, didn't have a lovely NHS or a nurse to call on all times. And, you know, there's this whole thing where, like, the Romans go through this period of hating Carthage. Like, they just hate Carthage. They really hate it. You have to say "down with Carthage" at the end of every speech. It's very important. Anyway, their anti-Carthage propaganda. They're like, those guys, they hate babies. They feed them to giant fiery statues of Baal. That's what they do with babies. We hate them, we're going to go smash them. And, you know, it turns out that archaeologically we can actually tell if this was in fact true. We did find a cemetery of infants. And it turns out that those infants are actually, they're sort of medical accidents. You know, they're the sad outcome of our species being incredibly bad at reproducing, which is tragic, but it is natural for us, not for any other animals, but it is for us. So I think a lot of the things we think about the past, we talk about the past a little bit like it's some other society, some other culture, which means that we're sort of condescending and a little bit othering. And, you know, essentially we're a little bit racist about people in the past. Like, oh, they didn't feel like we do. It's like, well, no, they probably did. They just had a suckier time of it.
Yeah. I mean, it well, and it must be, and you do touch on this in the book as well. Because of the book, I happened to be in Hitchin today, as I've just talked to you before the podcast, where I live nearby. I've never been to Hitchin Museum, but you mention in the book that there's a skeleton there of a mother who died in childbirth with triplets. And so I went to view that because I was right next door. I thought, let's go and have a look. And it's extremely harrowing to see this. Weirdly, I wrote a play about archaeology called Excavating Rita about 20 years ago, there was a skeleton in that who died giving birth with the baby in the grave as well, which is basically what this is. But and she was the first recorded case of someone with triplets, but unfortunately, obviously, the triplets didn't survive. How is that as, you know, obviously you're a scientist and an archaeologist, but it must be pretty harrowing to sort of come across that sort of stuff as you do in your job.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, my research is mostly focused on child health and growth, which means that I have to study the opposite of that. You know, that's something that I've always had to look at. I have to say that once you have kids of your own, suddenly there's a whole world of empathy. It just goes, oh, this is very sad, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's one of the things is, you know, archaeology is supposed to be there to balance this sort of sense of history, which is written by the victors, by the kings, by the important people. So, you know, if no one's going to tell the story about the kids and the women who had them and all the people who actually make up, you know, the human past, you know, we have to go through the miserable bits, which include, you know, the high proportion of children that didn't make it through infancy or didn't make it, you know, to adulthood, especially when we started inventing things like, you know, huge crowded urban worlds full of, you know, haves and have nots and really yeah. started to, you know, basically kill off a lot of our children.
Yeah. Well, talking again on this subject, there was a fact that I didn't know that I think I've got this right, and you are an expert on teeth, that is this true that birth's so traumatic for for us all when we're born that it leaves a line on our teeth, so you know if a baby's died before it was born because it won't have that line on its teeth. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so my technical PhD is in dental anthropology, and you're very sorry you just asked about teeth. But teeth are so fascinating. So teeth essentially are like a fossil in your mouth. You know, you chip a tooth, it doesn't grow back. It only grows once, but it grows while you're young. So it leaves this perfect record of everything that happened to you in childhood. So a lot of my research is on stresses that happen to you that sort of mess up, you know, the structure of the tooth. Chemistry of the tooth, which tells you like what you ate, what you drank, how long you were breastfed for. And we can actually see that there is almost always in certain teeth that are growing before you're born. So they're sort of up in your jaw, you know, just forming. We can actually see that there is a stress that happens at the time of birth. And then, of course, we can start counting days from this and do all sorts of incredible, cool science. But yeah, so that's one of the things that came out with that whole evil Carthaginian case.
Yeah,
that's how we knew is that these babies didn't actually, most of them didn't have that line, which meant that they never were born alive.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how we know that this whole feeding fiery statues of Baal screaming infants thing was sort of more Roman than perhaps accurate.
Yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Another thing that I didn't that I'd never heard before, and I suppose I sort of knew about this in an oblique sense, but not about this. You write about the placenta is not human.
No.
Would you like to explain?
Yes, I hardly can. It seems like a horrifying thing to do. But so, you know, a couple hundred million years ago, some enterprising vertebrate decided to capture a bit of RNA virus sort of DNA, well, RNA, and that became a weird temporary organ that mammals and only mammals can create, when they're pregnant. And it essentially acts as a filter that allows them to sort of embed their offspring inside their body. So forget eggs, where anyone could snack on them. You know, we're going to carry these eggs inside us. And the placentas just get weirder and weirder as you go on, because they're essentially devices for allowing a foreign object to start controlling the host, which is creepy, except for it's a baby, so it's cute, which is very difficult to reconcile. But human placentas are the weirdest. So, I mean, so all mammals mostly have them. You can think of like marsupials. They have crap ones, which is why they have to do the pouch thing.
Right.
You know, they're sort of halfway house. And then we've got, you know, primates have them. And in humans, basically the placenta is able to take a lot more control for the baby's needs than other animals. So when you think of, another mammal having a pregnancy, they don't get gestational diabetes. They don't get hypertension and preeclampsia and die romantically like that chick from Downton Abbey. You know, spoiler, sorry. But
I haven't seen it yet.
If you're ever going to watch it. But, you know, these like our pregnancies kill us. That's not normal. But it seems to be this sort of evolutionary compromise that we've made in order to have these insanely demanding babies, these babies that take so many calories from the mom. You know, if they want more blood to bathe in, they're going to ask for it, and you're going to get preeclampsia and die if you're not set up for it.
Right. Yeah, it is crazy. But you say that we're weird and babies are weird, and you know, it is such an interesting process when you look into it. You also look into childhood, obviously, as well, and this length of childhood and the games we play and all that sort of thing. So and which again is something fairly unique to human beings. I suppose there's other primates play, but
yeah. So play is a weird thing. Like play seems very, very useless. Except for it turns out that if you're a social animal, it's incredibly important, because like the whole thing with social animals is they have a lot more rules to learn. If you think about some animals that aren't even mammals that have super long childhoods, so like a crow is a kid for a really long time. And this is because they literally live in a society that is murderous. I mean, they have an intense social circle, and they need to learn where they're going to fit, who's above them, who's below them, how to get along in a sort of crow-eat-crow world. So crows are animals that essentially have this long juvenile period, which we think of as like the time for play, because they need to learn the rules of their society. And that appears in mammals. All little baby mammals sort of play a little tiny bit. And primates, they just turn up the volume. They ramp it up until you get to essentially us. But we can look at even like chimpanzees and their close cousins, bonobos. So chimpanzees are, they're separated by like 2 million years. They're not the same species at all. They just happen to look very, very similar. Not a mistake to make, though, because chimpanzees tend towards a lot of aggression. They have very male-dominated societies. Bonobos are the ones that are famous for having, like, hello sex, just because. They're very, they have a very different social organization. But if you look at the amount of time, and especially when, what age these animals play, you can see that chimpanzees, they do their play in their very early years, and then they kind of knock it off. There's no time for play. You know, mama chimpanzee has to teach her daughters how to hunt with spears, which is a thing they do. But in bonobos, it's more like, actually, they keep playing. They keep playing their whole lives. And humans are the same way, that essentially the way we play depends on our society. So we play in order to learn how to become the best member of the society that we're going to become. They've looked at differences in plays between like kids from like a more hunter-gatherer society, so a society with a little less importance of gender roles, you know, a little less structured, a little less hierarchical, and then nearby kids who are kids of agriculturalists, of farmers. And the farmers' kids, they actually they play less. They stop playing earlier, and they also, interestingly, they play more gendered roles from an earlier age than the kids the hunter gathers. And it just shows us, you know, what you play at is something that you know, you basically are learning in order to fit into your society. So that play is, important. And for every parent who has had a girl or boy child that has gone on to do something incredibly stereotypical, like play only with dolls, even though you insisted they were not going to wear pink and play with dolls, you know, it's not your fault. It's the society. You can't escape it. You got to keep them in a bubble if you want that not to happen.
And you do talk, I mean, again, I'm fascinated by the human story and where we came from and all the offshoots of humanity, although the homos that didn't make it through to the present day. What would you think was the difference for Homo sapiens? I mean, was it Homo sapiens the difference that knocked off all the others? Why did this genus of Homo survive and the other ones, who presumably were similar in their with childhood and babies, not survive?
There's going to be a lot of thought on this yeah. subject in the community. But I mean, so one of the really interesting suggestions, and again, from teeth, showing how interesting teeth are.
They are interesting.
Is that if you knock a tooth into a synchrotron, you can actually count the days that it was growing. And if you count the days you're growing, you know how long it took to grow, and you can compare that actual hard chronological age to like how the skeleton looks. So you can see in our earliest ancestors, you know, something that looks like a six-year-old actually grew in 3 years. So we know that's a faster childhood than we have. Mm-hmm. That little child did not have as long to learn the rules of the world, to have its society. And as you go down our line closer and closer to us, we see that actually that gets longer. So Neanderthals are a super interesting case. So they interbred with us. We shared a world in various parts of the world with them. But there's a slight indication that they may have grown just ever so slightly faster than us, that they may have matured a little bit quicker. So one of the interesting suggestions in the last decade or so is, you know, maybe it is just that extended childhood that's given us the edge. And, you know, that extended childhood is part and parcel of being social, of our incredibly dense social networks. One of the problems Neanderthals ran into is they kind of ran out of people to make more Neanderthals with.
Yeah.
You know, which is a problem for a species. That is not a problem our species has had.
Right. And we knocked them. You know, you do say that every time Homo sapiens turned up somewhere, the resident Homo got sort of the hobbit one that on the way down to Australia, that they sort of disappeared once Homo sapiens turned up and Neanderthals sort of disappeared.
Great news for anyone.
No. You know, it might just because we're so great. I mean, it is sort of interesting. I mean, all these things, it is a sort of mathematical equation. And it's because we happen to do this, it happens to work. And then we sort of are this incredibly successful species. And I think the book gives a decent argument to say that it is due to this. I mean, all mammals obviously are developing outside of the womb. So there are animals, well, you talk about spiders who are basically born as fully grown or have no infancy. But, you know, we're growing outside of that. We do most of our growing after we're born, which is even a giraffe can sort of run around pretty quickly.
Yeah. And whereas we, you know, I mean, physically, we don't mature until sometime after sort of 25. And this is always people's contention. It's like, well, when are we grown up? And it's like, well, socially, physically, biologically, what do you want? It's a movable feast. But physically, I mean, so the bone on your collarbone, so where your collarbone touches your chest bone, there's a little tiny flake of bone. And that actually doesn't even finish growing together until you're 30.
Okay.
So the next time you look at, you know, some MP under the age of 30 or something, you go, your collarbones aren't finished yet.
And it's interesting that, I mean, a lot of childhood, you know, you could define childhood as the time before you're fertile, but with human beings, don't generally speaking, and it's not just a societal thing, I think that, you know, fertility, we become fertile, but not generally having kids until, you know, 20, but often till 30 or more than that. You know, we put off the...
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not actually just us. So great apes also have this sort of awkward adolescent phase where they're technically capable, but no one would want them to reproduce. So you get situations where my favorite is the kind of gorilla boy band phenomenon. So gorillas live in a kind of one male harem situation. So there's a big silverback and he's got a bunch of females who live with him, but they're all going to have kids. And some of those kids are going to be males, and the males, they're going to grow up. They're going to be able to sexually reproduce, but they're definitely not going to be culturally able. They're not going to be able to challenge the big guy. So they got to go do something else. So they do. They go off and live in these like roving packs. You know, anthropology does not record them, you know, sort of singing or making dance videos. But, you know, they are essentially these boy bands wandering the jungle. And so we actually have in great apes and in all human societies a really long extended period. For us, it's much longer than other apes. But we have a period where there's this kind of useless adolescence, which isn't so useless after all. For great apes, we know that that's when a lot of information transfer happens.
Right.
So that's when a lot of stuff that you learned in your sort of birth group gets shared to the other groups that you're going to eventually join. And humans, you know, human teenagers are excellent at communicating with each other. If I understood TikTok at all, I would have a better point to make, but I don't. But, you know, it's a really interesting phenomenon. And we seem to have really taken that phase, you know, the sort of, let's say if you're technically capable of reproducing at 15, but you still haven't at 40, that's a big extension.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's me. There I am. In fact, you know, I definitely went through a long period where nobody was interested in even going through the motions of reproducing with me. So, you know, I sympathize with those gorillas. I mean, there's a lot more. There's some great stuff about births in the past. You kind of just skirt over it, but the invention of the chainsaw was death. Down to helping people in birth, which is again something we don't want to think about too much, maybe. But is that
there are small facts that live in archaeologists' heads that you will never go to enough cocktail parties to use all of these anecdotes. And I have an unfortunate habit of writing books that are essentially everything interesting I've ever wanted to say at a dinner party that proved to be inappropriate, and I held back. That's not true. I never held back. But you know, but yeah, I mean, the entire history of obstetrics is fascinating. So, you know, human birth is very difficult, and that's for a series of reasons, probably not the ones you think. We sort of may discount some of the older theories about walking upright and big brain babies. But one of the things we do culturally is make life even more difficult for women, particularly Scotland. So poor Scotland has not got a lot of natural sunlight. And during the Industrial Revolution, combination of pollution and poor nutrition meant there's absolute epidemics of rickets, which is the disease that makes your bones go soft. That's fine. You get bowed legs. It's not great, but it's fine. But you also get, if you're female, a bowed pelvis. And that prevents you from having a successful birth. So one of the reasons that Scottish medicine is so outstanding and so pioneering with anesthesia, with obstetrics, is because they literally faced an absolute crisis of women who had rickettic pelvises. They're basically smushed out of, you know, capacity to have a baby the normal way. And C-sections were not something that you were expected to survive. You know, they were not a sure thing at all. So a lot of the inventions that have gone into medical history have all been sort of, you know, based against necessity. Of course, that necessity is human created, which tells you a lot about why our species is where it is.
Yeah. And the just the invention of forceps as well, that men, the male doctors sort of kept this a secret, what they were doing so that they could make money. Have I remembered that right?
Yeah, no, so there's a family of male midwives. And there was sort of in constant competition with the previous sort of midwives who'd been female and had been down the road before. But the male midwives had, this family had invented the forceps, which did actually make a big difference in birthing. And It was a secret. So that's one of the reasons that people have argued that there is a sheet used to sort of cover the area, is that they were actually putting the sheet over the woman giving birth so no one would see what they were doing in order to save the baby. And because they charged a fortune, they ended, you know, the family sort of saw to royalty and things, and you had to pay money if you wanted this magical service. And then, of course, word got out, and then, yeah.
Someone saw the sheet came off. So, oh no, yeah, we've got big thing to put out. Right. I'm not going to keep you much longer, but just in case, you give birth. But I was interested to find out the facts about synchronizing of menstrual cycles, and also that humans have a breeding season. I did not realize that.
Have you never noticed that there is just a stupid number of birthdays in August?
I haven't really noticed it. I'm a July baby myself.
Well, you know what? That's pretty close. So it turns out there is something called a Christmas party season.
Right.
But it's really interesting. So, like, most primates actually do have seasonal breeding, because what you want to do in an uncertain world is time your baby for that moment when there's the most fruit on the trees, you know, the most insects in the air, whatever it is you're eating, you want to take advantage. And humans seem to do this as well. You can actually look at, like, the different latitudes, which will sort of determine growing season for things, so different amounts of light. And at different latitudes, humans reproduce slightly different times. There's sort of a bumper crop that seems to come along at exactly the ideal moment. But because we're humans, we mess with that massively by having essentially Christmas party season. So in the countries where you have a sort of midwinter, everything, all the rules are off, we're going to drink a lot, you unsurprisingly have a rash of 9 months later, you know, late summer births.
Okay.
And, we see that it's not just sort of modern day countries. There are people who don't use the Christmas calendar, Advent calendar system, who, you know, have equally obscure sort of timing. So there's a group of farmers who depend entirely on yams. Yams are super important, and they have a huge taboo on having sex during yam season. You just can't do it. It's wrong. You will be so in trouble. But 9 months after the end of yam season, there is a bumper crop of new yam farmers. So, these are, again, more amazing biological adaptations that humans have just messed with.
Sure. I both read the book and listened to the audiobooks, you know, in different times. Not twice, but I did both. I found it a bit. Usually, I prefer the audiobook first, but I didn't with this book. Maybe because there's so much in there that it's better to read it. Why did you not do your own audiobook, Brenner, is my first question.
I asked and I asked and I pushed and I said I want to do it because I have a weird, messed up transatlantic accent, and a friend of mine once read one of my books and he said, you know, this sounds exactly like you and it's so great, it's exactly your voice, and the thing is I can just shut the book whenever I want and it's fantastic. So apparently, you know, I have a particular voice, but Audible does not offer that kind of contract anymore, so that's what you get to do in a book with Audible.
I think it would have been better. I can't work out it might be me, and it might be the person reading the book, or it might just be the kind of book it is. But I found it quite hard to ingest the information in audio form. Whereas when I read it, it was very clear. And I think you got a very particular sense of humor as well. And I'm not sure the audio book reading always nailed it.
I think the woman who read it, I'm sure, is absolutely lovely. But I have noted that particularly my footnotes are Marmite. So if you come to science looking for the calm, reassuring voice of reason, perhaps you should look elsewhere. I have a lot of facts. I have a scientific career, but I am just physically incapable of being serious for that long. So there you go.
But that's good. I much prefer it when the author does it. So I'm sad that they didn't let you do it. And, I thought I might talk to you and discover you were unable to speak or something. And that might be the reason, but you seem to be, very capable of communicating. So I would say to Audible, who I do like, to employ the writer, unless they really don't want to do it.
Free the writers to make their own words.
Because there's a lot of information in this one, and I think it just, I don't know. I'm not criticizing the lady reading it, but because it could easily, equally just be my low attention span. I think
sometimes the accent is, you know, that there's a very calming American accent, which I think is,
yes,
it doesn't, it's not quite as frenetic, let's say, as my spoken voice.
I think that's true. And it's, I think it's, I was driving and I was tired, but it sometimes made me a little soporific, I have to say. So I would recommend with this one, reading the book, because you get a lot more out of it. And there's we haven't even touched on it, really. There's so much in this book.
Plus pictures of the first kids' potty. You'll miss that if you don't read the book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I did. I have flicked through, yeah.
I had to pay the Greek Ministry of Antiquities a large amount of money to reproduce a picture of a 1930s toddler successfully using a posh 7th century Athenian potty. So, that's worth the price of admission alone, surely.
That definitely is. Are there any books, Brenna, that your book was actually recommended to me in a previous podcast by Alice Roberts, who has a quote on the front of the book? Are there any books? And that's why I read the book. So thank you to Alice for directing me towards your book. It's fantastic. Are there any books you are reading that you'd like to recommend?
Well, hopefully by now everyone has read Rebecca Ragg Sykes' Kindred, which is just a beautiful, lyrical, incredibly well-written book about Neanderthals, and just not the Neanderthals you know, the cavemen of yore, but this beautiful look at sort of their societies, their art, their crafts, their lives. And it's quite a poetic book. It's the opposite of mine. It makes you sort of feel soaring and happy rather than giggling slightly at descriptions of monkeys falling out of trees.
Great. We'll look out for that one. Look, it's been really lovely to talk to you, Brenna. Good luck with the coming weeks and the awful reality of child. I'm glad you have to live through this after calling babies. Don't call your babies weird to their face. I mean, you can do it when they're babies.
Oh, it's too late.
I hope everything goes fine for you. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, for his fine production. And we'll be back next week. I'm not sure who's going to be the next guest yet, but maybe it'll be Kindred. We'll see. Thank you very much.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.